Does your app belong in the cloud? Why, yes, of course it does, because cloud. I think most companies have gotten away from that sort of thinking, as the because cloud approach has resulted in some bad architecture and some unexpectedly large bills. And so now everyone kind of knows that cloud adoption requires thought and care, analysis, a plan. Okay, so what apps do belong in the cloud then, and how do you figure that out? To help us answer these questions, Day 2 Cloud sponsor SolarWinds is joining us. SolarWinds makes a lot of tooling for IT, which I'm sure many of you that are out there know probably from personal experience with their products. Dave Wagner has joined us from SolarWinds to help us come up with a strategy for determining what apps should be in the cloud and what apps are better left on traditional infrastructure. Dave, welcome to Day 2 Cloud. Very nice to have you, sir. And let's jump into this with, we need to set some groundwork here. Let's define modern applications, Dave. Can you give us some characteristics of what a modern app is? And let's try to do it more than just buzzwords like, Kubernetes. Let's try to go a little deeper than that in defining modern applications.
Oh, come on. We can't play buzzword bingo here? I mean, really?
You can, but come on. Let's go a little deeper if we can.
Yeah, let's get into the meat of the matter. Okay, so the first off, I mean, one way to think of an app that belongs in the cloud is, first off, an app that's written to take advantage of the things that cloud architectures can uniquely deliver. If you've got an old-style monolithic app with all the code in one giant loop that ran, on a vertically scaled architecture. Yeah, you could port it over to the cloud, but that wasn't designed to be in the cloud. The cloud's all about dynamic scalability. It's all about ramping up, resources in small, well-defined chunks when you need them, and then getting rid of them when you don't need them. It was designed for that level of efficiency. And, if you think back, gosh, I guess I'm dating myself, but remember those old IBM commercials about, grid computing? And they were trying to introduce the original concept here, which is, elastic infrastructure available on demand. Well, what a lot of people didn't tell everyone at that time, and there's probably a few people that still don't know it, if the app isn't written in such a way to take advantage of it, it's kind of pointless to put it on the cloud. So it's got to be a horizontally scalable app, right?
People do lift and shift, though. I mean, you're kind of making it sound like lift and shift doesn't have a use case.
Oh, no, not absolutely not. No, lift and shift has a lot of benefits to it. But you're not taking advantage of a lot of the scalability aspects at the level that you could. You're taking advantage of them at the, if you lift and shift, let's say your private VMware, VM cloud, and you lift your VMs over there and dump them in the cloud, yeah, you're getting some advantages there in terms of dynamic scalability at that level of abstraction. But and so your monolithic app running on a VM can take advantage of the cloud that way. But that's only dipping your toes into it. I mean, with microservices-based architectures and stateless applications, you can literally scale out every or any component at whatever level of the application stack you want. And you certainly don't get that with a lift and shift. Lift and shift just gets you to the cloud faster with whatever you were doing. It isn't taking advantage of all those extra capabilities that you get with, here come the buzzwords, microservices-based applications written in modern languages deployed in containerized environments.
That's quite a mouthful of terms, but I think if I could break it down to what my key takeaway from that is traditional applications, and maybe we can define those in a moment, traditional applications don't scale independently. The different components of that application can't scale independently of each other. The kind of the whole idea of this breaking it up and decoupling and using containers and microservices was to give that scalability to individual components as opposed to just throwing a bigger server at the whole application.
Exactly. You're hitting on the key issue here, I think, and that is that, back in those days, the only way you could make a monolithic application scale, process more transactions per second or whatever you want to call it, the only way you could do that was faster clock rates on CPUs, or if the application was smart enough to take advantage of, symmetric multiprocessing architectures, adding more cores or more CPUs to servers. So those were the days where we started out with Unix workstations, and then we ended up with really large 32 and 64-way Unix boxes from HP, IBM, and Sun, right? But the problem, as you pointed out, is unless you decouple all the aspects of the application into separately scalable components, the increase in performance you'd get by adding those kinds of physical resources was limited to the weakest link. In other words, which part of that application required the incremental horsepower, the fastest, if you will. And so the only way to fix that, obviously, is to, you know, decompose that application into components, into services, microservices that are each separately horizontally scalable. So you can scale the aspects that need to be scaled when they need to be scaled. And you can't do that with a lift and ship of a JVM on a dedicated VM that you lift and shift over to the cloud. Does that make sense?
It does. Haven't we been down this path before? I seem to remember something called SOA, or like services-oriented architecture. Isn't this just a rehash of that, or is there more to it?
It's thematically very similar. And oh, by the way, we've been down it before. I mean, we could go way back and talk about when IBM introduced, you know, virtualization on their mainframes, if you wanted, or then we did the same thing on mini computers. It's been the same thing over and over again, with the level of abstraction getting ever smaller. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Ever more granular. Granular is probably a better term. So, you know, now, of course, all this flexibility and all this granularity is great, but, you know, it has some complications and some air quote costs associated with it.
Yeah, costs. I mean, one of those costs being complexity, just trying to deal with the those different levels of abstractions, the different layers of abstractions, where they are and how those different services interact with one another. It does get complex. So how do you decide, if you're looking at an application, whether it's worth the trade-off? Do I rebuild this whole app and separate out the services and then, you know, deploy so that I can take advantage of cloud? Or do I just leave this thing as it is and kind of go with scale up as opposed to scale out, like we were talking about earlier?
Yeah, I could give you the simple answer, which is yes, but no. It's really kind of all the above, right? And this is where you got to actually look at what are the workloads these applications are trying to accomplish. What are the data sets that are required for them to accomplish that work? So again, it's complexity. It requires planning. Okay, so just like back in the day when everybody was scale up with really expensive multi CPU, Unix boxes running SQL oriented backend data stores, et cetera, et cetera. Just like then, you have to do a form of capacity analysis, capacity planning. But it's a completely different process now. But the concepts are all the same. You know, where are you moving data from and to? How frequently? How much data? What are the latency requirements? And so you really need to look at and think about all these things. I've talked with a lot of companies that are, you know, they have a cloud-first strategy going forward for new apps. That's probably, and generally speaking, 9 times out of 10, a good idea, because it means you're not digging a technical debt hole any deeper. But then at the same time, they've got a whole series of, and this is not meant to be pejorative, I'll call them legacy apps. It's not a bad thing. Legacy apps built their entire industry, and they still continue to be the back end of much of the data of record for most companies. But they've still got a bunch of those applications that they would love to gain the scalability advantages of the cloud without having to completely rewrite everything starting from scratch. And so you get these sort of hybrid application architectures where some of the back-end data components that have already been engineered for massive scalability in the on-prem data center with the proprietary data stores need to interact with multiple tiers of an architecture that, as you get ever closer to the end user, or and I'll use end user in a broad sense here. End user could be programmatic access from outside the firewall on a transaction basis. But when they're doing that, they really need to think about where you can do those. I'll call them section lines. Where can you take the components of the application that lend themselves best to rebuilding in a horizontally scalable mode that makes maximum use of the cloud resources?
Dave, you said a lot there as we were talking through the different elements of the application stack and how you might consider them. One thing leapt right out to me early in that bit. You had mentioned, for example, moving data, how much data is coming into the app and out of the app. When you get involved with cloud and analyzing your use case of cloud for this specific application, things like data movement in and out of the cloud becomes part of that equation because there's a cost component to that. Are there other things there tied to cloud where maybe we have to think about it differently than we used to back in the day because how we pay for cloud is different than how we would have consumed infrastructure we'd installed and built ourselves?
Well, ironically, it isn't different. It's just manifests slightly differently. You know, back in those days, you had to worry about how much data you were moving over your proprietary network. You weren't paying for it at the packet by packet level or gigabytes per hour level, perhaps directly, but you made a capital purchase of the networking gear and everything else, and then you'd amortize it over time, right? So, and therefore you thought about, okay, what are my data volume needs? And I think people, when they first jumped to the cloud, in fact, the network costs were probably the biggest gap people didn't think about first, because they're like, oh, it's a cloud network. It's just magic. And oh, by the way, it's really cheap to get the data in, but if you want to send it out, guess what? So these are factors you need to think about. So when you're looking at your workloads, you need to think about, again, what are these workloads doing? What data do they need to interact with? What are the requirements on that interaction in terms of latency and throughput and cost? And what are the trade-offs associated with those three?
Interesting. It reminds me, so when I think about the things that I had to pay for in the data center, at some point I did have to pay for all of that networking gear. And it was not cheap. Like, Cisco does not give you a big discount on their, you know, core switching and routing. Mm-hmm. So I was paying for all of that, but to me, it's a sunk cost. I don't see that popping out every time I need to send a packet across the network. That's already been paid for to a certain degree. Now you're saying you're no longer paying that big upfront cost for all that networking gear, but you are paying the cost over time as you move data around your cloud network, right?
Exactly. It's literally, it's like a paradigm shift. Okay. I'm a flat earther. I actually collect vinyl records, and I know I could do Spotify. I know I could do a music service. I know I could do all that, but just to me, and it's just to me, this is my business case, if you will, to me, paying over and over again to listen to the same darn thing is stupid. I want to own it. Okay. Well, that was the old model. All right. The new model, you know, if you ask my son who keeps trying to pinch my credit card number so he can do Spotify and other things. He's like, why would you want to own all that crap? Hmm. And I'm like, well, because I know how much I paid for it and I'm not paying any more. So this is where the cost, you know, the cost is still the element. It's just the way you apply it and think about it. The philosophy is different. And so you just need to make sure you know that going in, and it needs to be planned in advance so there's no surprises. It's not necessarily bad. In many cases, it's better. You're paying on demand. So you're not paying for sunk capacity that, you know, oftentimes just sits there idle. So it, in that sense, it can be more efficient. But again, if you don't think about your need for it and your use of it in advance, it can, you know, be a real eye opener.
It really does imply, though, that you understand on your legacy infrastructure how much it's costing you, which isn't always a straightforward calculation. There's power, there's having the facilities, there's all the servers, there's hardware refreshes, and that can be, it can be like you kind of know, but it's not as easy to quantify necessarily as you might think.
Yeah, and that's why, I mean, if I think back to the companies I was talking with 5, 6, 7 years ago when cloud was first really kicking in, when cloud, at least for big companies, especially in things like healthcare or financial services or industries like that, where literally they were in, you know, building their own private clouds on-prem, doing infrastructure as a service with their virtual machines and their Java-based applications. They did it on a project-by-project basis so they could actually learn the questions that they had to ask, basically. I know that sounds a little silly, but that's effectively what they were doing.
Right. I really liked your metaphor of streaming services versus collecting vinyl, because they're both valid approaches to listening to music. And if you are the type of person who you like to purchase your music and own it, and you don't consume at a high rate, then purchasing it actually does make a lot of sense. If you're someone like me who consumes music vociferously, like I just really like listening to new music, the cost to me of purchasing a new album to discover whether or not I like it is pretty high. But if I just want to listen to a song or listen to a few songs once, then it makes a lot more sense for me to go with a streaming service. And exactly. If I draw that analogy back to the cloud, if there's an interesting technology that exists, I can tinker around in the cloud for very little cost. And then if I think it's going to be something that sticks around for a while, then I can make that decision. Do I try to deploy this technology on premises using my own hardware, or do I continue to consume it using the cloud?
Exactly. So now let's take that analogy one step further, because I think it actually works. So for example, I'm still buying vinyl. There are companies still making vinyl. I happen to think it sounds better than digital music. Okay, whatever. I also have tube-based hi-fi system. Anyway, the point is I go on YouTube that I don't have to pay for my new music fix to find out whether or not I want to buy something. So I would call that the hybrid approach between, you know, streaming music services and owning your CDs or your albums. So, you know, there's this approach that says, you know, neither is perfect, neither is ideal. Both are fit for purpose. The whole point here is which applications need which purpose or which mix of purposes. And a lot of them need that hybrid, a lot.
Dave, I want to go back to something we were talking a little bit about earlier, that is lift and shift. So if I forklift my legacy app, I put it into the public cloud, you would said, yeah, you could do that. And there's some benefits you get to take advantage of in the cloud. But are there also problems that I should be thinking about and aware of before I take that step?
Yeah. So, I mean, the biggest problem I would see with lift and shift is that you may run into issues with latency in terms of access to data. I mean, if you literally move the entire application environment over there and all the databases and everything else, again, depending on the application and use case, you may have created a situation where you're moving way more data, way more times in and out of the cloud than you would necessarily need to if you re-architected. So you may be driving up your cost baselines would be one issue.
Wait a minute. With moving data in and out of the cloud way more times, how do you mean? Because if I lift and shift, in theory, I pick it all up and I move it and it's there now. Yes, I've got a longer network distance to get to it, but isn't it all in the one place?
Sure. Well, aside from latency, let's think about more of a B2B kind of use case, which involves massive amounts of data that need to be transferred. If you lift and shifted an application that's moving, you know, gigabytes of data in batch chunks, and you take that off your on-prem data center, which is already, you know, cost amortized or whatever, and you put it into the cloud and you're pumping that kind of data out, you know, that probably isn't a really good use case for a lift and shift application, something that's moving large quantities of data.
Because the nature of the application is stuff that is such that there is a data exchange that's going on between a couple of endpoints. And so I'm having to cross the cloud border, if you will, over and over again with lots and lots of data.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. And then, you know, there's some other, you know, physics related things like latency. I mean, and that would relate to certain applications that are time sensitive. So for example, a couple of years ago, I was on site at a very large financial services company in New York that I won't mention. But they were, you know, they had done, I mentioned before, they had done a lot of infrastructure as a service private cloud. And they decided they had to stay on-prem because they were worried about things like sub-second high frequency trading environments and settling transactions. So yeah, they could have moved it to a public cloud environment. But it wouldn't meet, you know, the latency requirements. The data transfers weren't huge, but they were really, really fast and stateful. So, you know, again, every app, every workload is going to be different in a lot of these dimensions. But the dimensions you need to map back to are, you know, what are you doing with storage? Where is storage? How much does storage cost? What are you doing with the network? Where are you moving data? How much data? How quickly does it have to get there? And what are the costs associated with that software pipe, which is what the cloud network is now. It's a software pipe instead of a hardware pipe, right? And then same thing for compute. Compute's a lot easier. Pretty much everybody's figured out the compute, the dynamic compute thing, and you don't need to be containerized microservices apps to take advantage of cloud compute. You can literally do, you know, VMs on the cloud and take advantage of the efficiency there. But storage and network, a little more complicated, and they tend to vary a lot more application by application.
Now, let's say my application, I lifted it up, I forklifted it into the public cloud, and I'm realizing all of these issues. Oh my goodness, like I am literally moving terabytes of data back down to my data center because some application in my data center is consuming it. Are you seeing people do this thing that I've heard called cloud repatriation, which is really just moving your app back? Because we've talked to some folks who are like, oh yeah, that's totally a thing. It's happening everywhere. And other people are like, no, what are you talking about? So I'm curious to get your view and experience on that.
Yeah, so I feel strongly both ways. So let me explain why, okay? So in my view of the universe, if you are considering a repatriation back off the cloud, it basically indicates a fundamental lack of planning in the first place. Now, that is not that's not a negative statement about folks who did that. In many cases, they were literally not allowed to do the plan. There were many cases I've heard people that literally, no, we have an edict from senior management, period. It is cloud first for all net new and lift and shift for all existing, period. There shall be no exceptions. Okay. And, you salute the flag, you march down that path. But the realities that we've described, physics, latency, throughput, cost, in that kind of environment where you didn't do that level of planning, I can easily see instances where lift and shift has to be, repatriate a subset of that. So that's sort of why I feel strongly about it both ways. Again, it gets back to planning. That hasn't changed in the last 40 or 50 years of our technology. If you don't plan how to optimize your use of these new technologies, you're going to run into problems. And sometimes that means, drop the clutch, shift down a couple of gears, go back and start over. So.
All right. So it sounds like one of the fundamental issues here that you're going to run into, and the reason this cloud repatriation thing happens, is because you didn't do the homework ahead of time, or you weren't allowed to do the homework ahead of time, because I've definitely been part of that as well. So let's talk about workload assessment. What is workload assessment? How would I go about doing that?
Okay, workload assessment. So way back in the day, we used to call it workload characterization, back when we actually had to plan how much CPU, compute, storage, IO, network we needed. But it really involves gathering performance metrics over time of demand and utilization of all the resources associated with each workload. So and the reason you have to do it over time is you have to encompass any and all business cycle variance in terms of, changes in dynamic demand on the application and the resources for that application. It's not hard, it requires time. Okay. Now the good news is generally, not always, but generally people have been doing that for their on-prem environments with their monolithic applications and the like. And the reason they were doing that is because every year they had to come up with a plan for how much resource they needed to buy. How big did their failover or disaster recovery site need to be, and questions like that. All those same kinds of questions need to be thought of and answered with respect to your workloads. You need to know how much compute resource do they need? When do they need it? How many IOPS do they need? And things like that over time.
And it's a loaded question, Dave, too, because you don't want to do what we all did back in the day, which was overspec that sucker as big as possible, as much budget as you'll give me, buy that, because you pay extra for that in the cloud. And if you're doing that needlessly, that means your bill is way bigger than you want it to be.
Yeah, and here's a dirty little secret, and that hasn't changed either. Just because you bought the biggest darn thing that was available didn't mean you were going to guarantee performance. It might not have been the bottleneck. So it really comes back to measuring the aspects of your application in terms of how are they moving things around? Well, there's the engine that is the logic that drives the moving things around. That's the CPU. There's the actual moving it around. That's your IOs per second to storage and your data volumes over the network. There's all the latency metrics. How fast is the data need to be moving? How fast is it moving? How does that change over time under demand? So in a sense, it's classic capacity planning in a very unclassic world, but the concepts are the same. We've done things in the past where we basically said, look, the verb, the nouns have all changed, but all the verbs are the same.
It's capacity planning where getting it wrong because you guess has a financial penalty assigned to it. So you can't merely guess. You actually have to know going in what you really need.
Well, yeah, you have to know. The difference is in the old days, if you didn't know what you needed going in and you had insufficient capacity, you were down. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now you're not down. You're just all of a sudden presented with a bill that's like, holy moly. Right? So it's bad. It's not quite as bad as it used to be. But it's so much more convenient that it's just so easy to fall into that trap of, I'll just scale it dynamically until I figure it out. Okay. So.
Right. It kind of reminds me a little bit of when we made that transition from physical servers to virtual machines. Mm-hmm. And suddenly we had the opportunity to resize what we had done before, because in the physical machine world, you were pretty much stuck with that physical machine for the next 5 years minimum. So you had to spec out to what you think it would have to do 5 years from now and then add 50% to that because you don't want to run out of capacity. And the budget cycle is giving you the money right now. So take it, right?
Yeah. And good luck if it worked, because many times that didn't work because, as you know, latency and throughput do not scale linearly with demand. So
they do not. Yeah. And then we had the opportunity with virtual machines to go, okay, well, you asked for this, you know, physical machine that has 16 cores and 128 gig of RAM, and you're using 2 cores and 4 gig of RAM. So I'm going to give you a slightly smaller virtual machine, but I can scale you up if you need it. But there was still some capacity planning that had to go into the virtual infrastructure that was running your virtual machines. Now we're moving to a cloud infrastructure where you have a basically infinite scalability. So it doesn't necessarily hurt you to undersize things a little bit and then add that scaling, as long as you can do it, like you said, in a dynamic way. But I feel like that's not always an option with some of these applications.
Yeah, and again, it gets back to the applications, right? Are the applications actually written properly to take advantage of these scalable architectures? So to me, if they are, then to me, that defines a modern application, and we've come full circle to our start here today. if you haven't, you know, you're gonna still run into these issues. And guess what? Instead of VM sprawl, which was like all the rage, what, 10 years ago, you're gonna have cloud sprawl, okay? Same cause. Same effect. You're spending more money than you need to. Maybe one advantage of cloud sprawl over VM sprawl is it's way easier to decommission. But you know, otherwise, it's the same concept. Like I said, it's the same verbs. It's just the nouns have changed, right?
So, Dave, let's get into some nuts and bolts here about this. We've been talking about general characteristics of the kinds of workloads that are going to work in the cloud and the ones that aren't, and then some of the challenges that we're going to run into if we get this wrong. How do I gather metrics? What is my thinking process to analyze an application and determine it's a fit for the cloud or it is not a fit for the cloud?
Okay, well, the first thing you need to do is establish a baseline in terms of what are its resource requirements and those behaviors for resource requirements over time. So that involves monitoring, and you got to monitor everything. Well, the good news is, generally speaking, most people are monitoring things in their legacy environment. So you need to gather all that data together. And really look at those performance metrics, you know, the gazins and the gazouts of the application, if you will, over time. That's literally, you know, homework statement number one. Number two then is to, and this generally involves people involved with the creation of the application itself, really looking at the application architecture itself in terms of where are there opportunities to partition it into components that, can maximally take advantage of the cloud versus those components that literally would not benefit at all from the cloud. And as a result, most of the people I'm talking to that are taking these kinds of approaches are ending up with a hybrid application environment where they're rewriting, you know, the so-called front ends of applications to interface with back-end architectures. And that's especially happening now with all the amazing excitement we've been going through in 2020, right? Where, you know, companies are like, oh my gosh, I've literally got to somehow put this thing online yesterday. Okay, well, they're not writing it from scratch, I guarantee you. So
your choice of words, amazing excitement, to describe 2020 is maybe not the words I would have chosen.
Yeah, well, you told me not to swear. So
exactly. There's a thing here we got to go back to, and you use the phrase repeatedly, over time. That is, I'm looking at my resource utilization over time. So when I would have historically done capacity planning, I would have looked at over time as I'm looking for peak loads. End of month, there's an accounting cycle, and so we have a bigger load on the financial system. Or I'm in a retail environment, and it's the Black Friday cycle, et cetera, et cetera.
Exactly. Yep.
So what does peak mean to me when I'm thinking about cloud? Because I don't have to have all that capacity sitting there waiting for me, I can go elastic and kind of use it on demand. Does that impact my thinking?
Yeah, you're right. I mean, in the old days, that's exactly how that sort of performance metrics over time, also known as capacity analysis, was done. But how do you deal with situations where, like, you've got this spike in demand that you never encountered before? See, that's where cloud is really, really useful. Back in the old days, you literally had to build models and do what-if scenario planning to say, well, what if the load went 3 times beyond what we ever experienced before? And then, okay, it would need resource X, And then it was a business decision, do we provision to that or not? Okay. And it was interesting because back in the 80s, companies would provision to a cost-effective level. And then we had the very first stock market black swan event in 1987. I remember it vividly. One of our customers, we actually sold modeling software that could predict these things. And he'd used it. He predicted what would happen if there was the first billion share trade day. There'd never even been a half billion share trade day. And they were the only exchange that was able to settle in time and not face financial penalties from the government. Okay. Well, the beauty of the cloud is you don't have to worry about that, but you do have to worry about it from the sense of which pieces of the application can scale like that.
Yes.
And again, we're full circle, right? So it really involves decomposing the application's architecture into the pieces that are most needed to take advantage of unpredictable spikes in demand and put all of that in the cloud because it is elastic.
Would you agree that if my application architecture is such that if I am able to break it up, but there's some component that can't scale, therefore I've got to go with like provision as much cloud infrastructure as I could possibly need on my biggest day? Do you think that makes it then too expensive to bother and I'd need to just keep it on premises?
That's going to vary on a case by case basis, I think. I could see there are certain business models where, you know what, it has to be. And so we will provision it that way. So I'm thinking life or death scenarios. I'm thinking of high value transaction processing environments where if you drop a transaction, it could be millions of dollars. And yes, those do exist. Mm-hmm. Again, it's that becomes a business decision at the end of the day. And you have to do a risk reward analysis on the cost versus, you know, the risk. So I wish it were simpler than that. I can't envision how it could be, though. At the end of the day, judgment still needs to be involved.
Come on, Dave. We deal in absolutes around here. This is technology. Oh, wait. No, we don't. We deal with it depends.
Didn't we just say it was 2020? It was such an excellent and exciting year. Absolutes? Really? Okay. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, I guess it all comes back to it depends. Right?
Yeah, it depends. But, you know, it isn't as grim as it depends. Oh, my gosh, where do I start? I mean, all these disciplines exist and have existed for a very long time. This is not rocket science in the sense of we've invented something fundamentally new. We're just abstracting out elements that were always there. All applications always had bottlenecks. And the whole point of an application developer, engineer, sysadmin working with them closely was to figure out where are those bottlenecks, when do they occur, what are the resources associated with them, and how do I optimize around that? And sometimes the optimize around it was in the way you provisioned and what type of resources they were. And sometimes it was, hey, you got to change the way the application logic works. And sometimes it's both. That hasn't changed.
Speaking of bottlenecks, Dave. Databases. Ha! Hey.
Oh, excellent.
So,
hey,
so
how I heard a rumor, it's the database's fault.
So how do databases factor into my cloud or no cloud decision for an app, there being a bazillion different PaaS services that could be my database for me?
Again, you apply the same logic, right? You're still moving data into or out of a store of record. And now that might be a traditional, large-scale SQL data store. It might be a Hadoop, big data warehouse. It might be a NoSQL cloud store, Mongo, Redis, you name it. The concepts are still all the same. At the end of the day, it's a place that I/O is being done to and from. Now, I'm speaking from it from that perspective because of the cost aspects. You know, the other half of the database is really the I'll use air quotes, the compute engine portion of the database, the way it efficiently looks up data based on how it's asked to do so. So for example, I remember when HDFS first became all the rage and data warehouses first became all the rage, I don't know, gosh, 10, 12 years ago. If I'm off by a few years, forgive me. But I remember I talking to a couple of large customers of mine at the time in brokerage and financial services, and they're like, yeah, we call it our write-only database. So, really easy to put it all in, but God forbid if you wanted to get anything useful out of it in any kind of reasonable time. I mention that just because these different technologies for database, whether they be SQL, NoSQL, or what have you, again, also have applicability to the way you're using them. Again, we get back into this, you're either on-prem, you're hybrid, or you're full cloud. Most everybody is going to be a hybrid when it comes to their database strategy as well, for all the same reasons. If the data is so significant to a company, it's so important, it's so secure, it's so proprietary, and we've got it in our, oh, let's get really, really crazy here. We've got it on our giant Z series mainframe running, you know, Z Linux. and we're never going to change it because you know what? It hasn't been down in the last 25 years. So we're not changing it. It's probably not a great idea to try and lift and shift that.
So you've worked with some government customers, Dave, I take it. I have in the Z series mainframes, which just seemed to be around forever because there were certain apps that just weren't going to leave.
Yeah, it's like, just as an aside, oh my gosh, if I could still admit that I know how to do COBOL programming and write JCL, I could probably make five times what I currently do, but I have my dignity. anyway.
That's fair. So it sounds like what you're saying is almost every organization is going to have something that remains on premises because of the fact that they have existing stuff that just doesn't move nicely. And that does seem to be the case that's being borne out at the moment. Should those on-premises things be moved into something that is more cloud-like, like an in-house private cloud? I think you kind of alluded to that for some organizations. Or does it make sense to just leave them on their VM hypervisor platform or even their mainframe?
Yeah, I mean, the ones that should be left on the mainframe are dwindling, and they're dwindling pretty quickly. And they're dwindling quickly, not so much because the technology can't handle it, but because, as I mentioned before, the folks that know how to run mainframes, you know, we're getting super, super old, and we super don't want to do that anymore. So that's part of it. But no, most of the companies I've talked with over the last 10, 12 years have literally gone down the route of, you know, and this is why virtualization took off. They've literally gone down the route of basically building on-prem private clouds and then going from there to public cloud on a case-by-case basis. And that's why I think if you look at that distribution bell curve from 100% on-prem to 100% cloud, you know, four out of the five standard deviations are clustered around that middle sort of hybrid mm-hmm. space. Now, if I were a net new company starting from scratch and I wanted IT technology, I would have a cloud-only strategy.
Hmm.
Okay, but how many of those really are there?
Do you therefore see hybrid cloud as a transitional strategy? I mean, maybe a long-term one that's many years, but eventually, no matter what company you are, it's all in the cloud?
I would love to say yes, but hashtag we just talked about mainframes. So if by several years you meant decades, I'd say sure. I mean, I literally one of my friends was the last existing VAX VMS expert for what used to be Digital and then was Compaq and then was HP. The last VAXes were only just shut down last year. Okay.
Wow.
And they came out in the 70s. Okay. Mm. Mainframes are still around. Okay. Client server, you know, I'm sure you could probably find Banyan Vines or Novell Network environments out there. Okay. My point is, nothing ever dies. It kind of fades away, but it never dies. So yeah, I think hybrid is here forever. I think more and more goes to the cloud, but you know, I'm sorry, after all these decades, I will never make a blanket statement that something is dead or going away. Just, I can't do it.
Yeah, yeah. The tail is mighty and long when it comes to technology.
Yes, but can you live tail it with a logging solution?
I think so. I think if I just do tail-f, I'm good, right? That's how it works.
Not so much on ZOS, I'm just thinking. But
oh, anyway. That's sad. Well, we've been mostly talking about an application. I've got this app. I want to move it to the cloud, or should it stay on-prem? But apps do this pesky thing where they talk to each other.
Oh, bummer.
And have dependencies, which is just awful and ruins all of my weekend plans. So if I do want to discover these pesky dependencies, is there anything different about the sort of assessment phase? And is there a way that you map this out to, you know, ensure that your application migration, if that's what you want to do, actually works out?
Yeah, and that gets into why one of the reasons why technologies that are called application performance management or application performance monitoring are really becoming more and more prevalent. And these all started out, as with all our technologies, with a great idea, with a single purpose. If we think back to the the probably the progenitor of all this was the old Wiley Introscope, which allowed you to get visibility inside your Java application, and you could trace what was going on and profile the code and figure out how much time was being spent at each element. They've come a long way since then. And now modern APM solutions can literally go in and trace service dependencies in basically in real time across the different services and layers of the application stack, profile the code while doing it, and capture all that data so that you can actually know what are the dependencies, what are the interactions, when are the interactions. So when I spoke before about, you know, monitoring and gathering performance data over time, to do that properly today, you have to use APM technology. Because as you mentioned, those interdependencies are extremely complicated to start with in the best of worlds. And if you've layered your application into various stacks to take advantage of dynamic componentry and scale on demand of all the elements, it's changing all the time and it's super complicated. So yeah, you got to keep track of that stuff. The only way I know of that is profiling and tracing, and APM solutions do that. So I would not be in a situation where I was migrating applications to the cloud or migrating parts of an application to the cloud and leaving other parts, you know, on-prem or in my private cloud on-prem, without having first, if you will, baselined it over time with an APM tool to understand its actual behavior of all the service elements and how they relate.
Well, Dave, this conversation has been interesting in that you guys as SolarWinds are the sponsor for today's show, and we haven't talked SolarWinds like at all. Now, what's interesting to me about SolarWinds, you guys have been doing a lot of acquisitions, integrating the tools of those acquisitions into a platform, including APM. Can you talk a bit about, if I'm looking at the SolarWinds product catalog, which is voluminous, lots of products that you guys have, which ones would I be focusing on to help me with this conversation, figuring out which of my apps would go to the cloud or not?
Okay, so if you're like an on-prem, and I'll try to keep this as non-vendory as possible because I know it sucks to listen to commercials. but you know the bottom line is we've basically been delivering, you know, monitoring of everything that matters in a way that's super easy and super friendly for IT pros to use for decades now, over 20 years. We're in our 21st year, I think. And that's everything from network to storage to applications to servers, you name it. If you're starting from an on-prem environment and you're wanting to assess and figure out how you want to get to and which workloads might be best to do lift and shifts or migrate to the cloud, we have our server and application monitor product. And it does an excellent job there of gathering all those. It's got over 1,000 out-of-the-box templates for all sorts of commercial packaged applications so that you can not only understand, you know, the server components themselves, but the actual packaged apps. Maybe you want to migrate an Office 365 to a cloud, for an example. And so there's a lot of things there. We've even got a costing calculator that you can use with that to do that. As far as while and as you are now deploying things in the cloud, we have our AppOptics, Loggly, and Pingdom solutions. These are SaaS-based solutions, not deployed on-prem or deployed as a set of virtual machines in the cloud, but they're SaaS-based that do application profiling, transaction tracing, log aggregation, end-user experience, and combine that into a solution where you can understand, okay, this application transaction is taking this much time. Here's what the profile looks like. Oh, guess what? In the last 3 seconds of response time, we're spent in 97 calls down to MongoDB. And, you know, maybe you might want to look at optimizing your queries or something like that. So, you know, we've got components for both ends of the journey as well as for, you know, wherever you are in the middle. And again, it gets back to, you know, everything depends on what you're trying to do.
Well, Dave, then leave us with some takeaways. If you got some action items for the folks that are listening to this, as they're evaluating which apps go to the cloud and which ones don't, what would you recommend?
All right. So number one, this should be a mantra taught to everybody that ever even learns anything about computers. It's always about performance. It's always about how fast a transaction's getting done and how much work is getting done in terms of how the beneficiary of it measures it. So yeah, if you're a B2C, it's about how fast is that click on that web page get me to buy what I'm going to buy or the room I want to book or the airline flight or any of those things. It's about performance. Performance in metrics that matter, response time, throughput, errors, latency. So think the golden signals from Google. All right. Now, once you understand that takeaway, and you really need to like just grok it, it needs to be burned into the way you think about everything. The second one would be, okay, performance is always limited by capacity somewhere. Okay, the cloud doesn't fix that. It merely changes it. And so keep that in mind. At the end of the day, every single transactional unit of work, every single tick of a CPU clock, even if it's virtualized and up in the cloud, is still being done on a physical piece of gear somewhere that is shared with other things. And when you share things, you're prone to have tantrums. Anybody who has more than one kid knows that, you know, getting people to share things, getting workloads to share resources doesn't always work out. And so you have to factor capacity in. And again, that gets back to understanding the profile of your workloads over time. So number one, performance. Number two, capacity is the constraint. And then there's a third constraint. And again, this one has never changed. It's cost. All aspects of the cost lever. So the costs of mitigating the risk of not having sufficient capacity, the cost of over-provisioning, the cost of under-provisioning, the cost of not thinking about, oh, darn, we have to move all that data back out of our cloud one more time to do some transformation on it, and then move it back into the cloud before we can service a transaction. So performance, capacity, and costs. Those would be my three takeaways.
Got it.
Apply those as a philosophy over the whole process.
And what's funny is it sounds like such a familiar philosophy for any of us that have been building apps over years. I mean, this is, yes, it's a cloud context now, but it's not new, Ned, is it?
No, you're right. I think David put it best where it's the verbs haven't changed, just the nouns have. So instead of on-prem, we say cloud. And when we're saying cost, well, I guess that hasn't really changed because we care about performance, user experience, and cost.
Well, Dave, let's wrap this up, this excellent conversation, thought-provoking. If you have a URL you could recommend to folks, where should they go to find out more about SolarWinds and APM?
Sure. So the best place I would recommend for folks that want to find out more about all our APM solutions here at SolarWinds would be go to www.solarwinds.com/APM solutions.
SolarWinds.com/APM solutions. And Dave, are you out there on the internet? Are you social, LinkedIn, Twitter, something like that, where people could get a hold of you if they want?
Yep, I'm on LinkedIn. I don't like to do the whole social thing because I just don't have enough bandwidth in my day and I've got to plan my capacity. So having that kind of dynamic, yep, that dynamic demand on my time is a little distracting to me. But yes, I am on LinkedIn.
Very good. Thank you very much, Dave Wagner from SolarWinds, for joining us today for this discussion. And thanks to SolarWinds for sponsoring today's Day 2 Cloud Show, because our sponsors are a very key part of the IT community, right? They employ the folks that make the clouds and the internet work, and they help us to pay our bills. We are proud to have vendors to be a part of the conversation here. And if you made it this far, hey, virtual high fives to you for feeding Day 2 Cloud into your earbuds. The goal is discussion, education, perspective, and opinion. So if you have suggestions for topics, or maybe you want to be a guest on the show because you got a great story to tell, absolutely, let us know. I'm on Twitter at EC Banks, and Ned is at Ned1313. Until then, just remember, cloud is what happens while IT is making other plans.